Sri Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai, Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai, Gangamayi Jamuna Devi Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai, Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premanandi. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada Nama Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Sri Mati Bhakti Vinata Swami Niti Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pacharani Nivase Sasumi Vadi Paskatya Desatani Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavam Sri Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Gitam Stam Sajina Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Purijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Deva Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Gitam Sri Vatana Pachubhishcha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. April 29th, 2019, in Denver, Colorado, when we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 26, Fundamental Principles of Material Nature, Text 34. Bhutanam chidradatritvam bahirantaramevacha kanindriyatam jishyatvam Nabaso Vritti Lakshanam. Bhutanam, of all living entities, Chidradatritvam, the accommodation of room, Bahi, external, Antaram, internal, Eva, also, Cha, and Prana, of the vital air, Indriya, the senses, Atma, and the mind, Jishnyatvam, being the field of activities, Navasaha, of the ethereal element, Vritti, activities, Lakshanam, characteristics, Srila Prabhupada's translation in purport. The activities and characteristics of the ethereal element can be observed as accommodation for the room for the external and internal existences of all living entities, namely the field of activities of the vital air, the senses, and the mind. Purport. The mind, the senses, and the vital force or living entity have forms, although they are not visible to the naked eye. Form rests in subtle existence in the sky, and internally it is perceived as the veins within the body and the circulation of the vital air. Externally, there are invisible forms of sense objects. The production of the invisible sense objects is the external activity of the ethereal element, and the circulation of vital air and blood in it is its internal activity. That subtle forms exist in the ether has been proven by modern science, by transmission of television, by which forms or photographs of one place are transmitted to another place by the action of the ethereal element. That is very nicely explained here. This verse is the potential basis of great scientific research work, for it explains how subtle forms are generated from the ethereal element, what their characteristics and actions are, and how the tangible elements, namely air, fire, water, and earth, are manifested from the subtle form. Mental activities or psychological actions of thinking, feeling, and willing are also activities on the platform of ethereal existence. The statement in Bhagavad Gita that the mental situation at the time of death is the basis for the next birth is also corroborated in this verse. Mental existence transforms into tangible form as soon as there is an opportunity due to contamination or development of the gross elements from subtle form. Bhutanam chidradatritvam bahir antaram evacha pranendriyatmadishinatvam nabaso vritti lakshanam. The activities and characteristics of the ethereal element can be observed as accommodation for the room for the external and internal existences of all living entities, namely the field of activities of the vital air, the senses, and the mind. So Srila Prabhupada, when giving a lecture on this verse, talked about how we should understand not only that there is one God, but that how He expands into many, how He expands into all of the elements of the material world. Of course, Krishna doesn't expand into the elements of the material world by a transformation of Himself, but rather by a transformation of His energies, just like those of us who've had children. So it's not like our finger became our child. It's not like we transformed our hand into our child. But it was a transformation of our energies that produced our child. And we still remain whole, right? The mother and father remain whole even after giving birth to a child, right? So Krishna remains whole and complete. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnami Vavasishite Purnasya Purnam Adaya. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purna Purna Pudachite Purnasya Purnam Adaya Purnam Eva Vashishite. So you can, from the complete comes, you take the complete away from the complete, still the complete remains. So this is the Lord manifest first in sound. What was that sound? Which then creates space. And from space creates everything else. So from subtle to gross. From subtle to gross. So the most subtle is the Lord Himself. And that creates space, which creates sound, which is very subtle, which creates space. And space, of course, is very, very subtle. Huh? So we know there is space. If there was not space in this room, here it says, accommodation for the room. If there was not space in this room, everything would just collapse. Yeah? I mean, I've read where that if you took all the human bodies on this planet and you were able to suck out all the space, that all the matter that exists in all the human bodies, devoid of the space, would all collapse into a very tiny, tiny ball. You know, we're thinking 7 billion people walking around the planet. We take up a lot of room. But actually, most of our bodies are just space. As it says here, that there's also space internally. Prabhupada talks about the veins and the vital air. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur talks about the nadis. The nadis are the subtle channels of energy. If any of you have ever had acupuncture treatment, they're working with the meridians, or in Ayurveda called the nadis. So there's space inside of our body, there's space outside of our body, and space defines everything, isn't it? Yes? Everything is defined by where it is in space. So I didn't really understand that until for about 5 years I traveled without a base, without any home. And what I discovered was that strangers will ask you where you're from. So a question that is okay by modern etiquette to ask a stranger is, where are you from? To ask what you do for a living or what's your name, that requires a little bit more intimacy. But where are you from, you can ask anybody. Anybody can ask anybody where they're from. I never noticed that until I didn't have an answer. You know, if I said, well, I'm from New York, then people assumed that I still lived in New York. And that, no, I haven't lived there for many years. So after a while, I realized that the only answer was, I just travel. And then some people would get very confused by that and say, but no, where are you when you're not traveling? I say, well, no, I'm always traveling. And then they kept trying to define me geographically. And then they'd say, well, where do you spend the most time? And I'd say, well, which month? You know, which year? It's constantly changing. And most people just couldn't get that. They couldn't work with that. You know, where are you? I remember my youngest son was saying, Mati, you shouldn't tell people that you don't have a home. He said, I don't feel comfortable telling people that my mother is homeless. And I said, well, it's not like that. It's not like I'm living in a park or something like that. But the point is that I realized that people couldn't, they had to place me geographically someplace so they couldn't make sense out of me. And I realized that that's true about everything. We want, in order to make sense out of something, we have to see what is its relation to the whole. Where does it fit in with the whole picture? And that we understand by space. And also with our own things. We organize our own things spatially, don't we? Don't we organize our clothes and our kitchen, and right? In terms of space. It allows us to make sense out of everything. And we can understand, therefore, that space, in one sense, is Krishna. Bhumila Panalo Vayu Kamano Buddha Evacha. Because without Krishna, nothing makes sense. If you don't relate something to Krishna, it has no sense in and of its own. It has no meaning in and of itself without being related to Krishna. So in this way, and many other ways, we can understand space. I think we were talking the other day, because we've been talking about the elements, about how we want... Did I tell you about how my granddaughter took the keys off the keyboard? Did I tell you about that? Yeah, she wanted... Recently she told me, I mean, now she's almost 14. She said, "Hey, Grandma, I did that because I wanted to see what was under them." And so my daughter-in-law had no space bar, and she's typing to me, and I couldn't make any sense out of what she was typing without spaces. And it's the same when we speak, if there's no pause, right? Then I went down to Parker Center, saw somebody, and you wouldn't be able to understand anything unless there's some sort of a pause between words, between sentences. Music would have no beauty if there was no space, right? And if someone paints a picture, I mean, I know people do this, and they sell it for a lot of money, but if you just painted a picture and all it was just black over the whole canvas, right? Without some sort of space, without some sort of demarcation, it's not beautiful, and it doesn't make any sense. We can't. So in the same way, without Krishna, nothing makes sense. We can't define anything, we can't understand its value, and we can find Krishna in the qualities of all of the sense objects, the senses, and the elements, because all of these are manifestations of his energy, because they all start with him in the form of Omkara. Does that make sense to everybody? Therefore, Krishna says, "I am everywhere. I am everywhere. Everything is in me." Of course, he's this wonderful verse in Bhagavad Gita, "Maya tatam idam sarvam jagadavyakti murtina matstani sambhutani nachahamte surastita." By me, in my unmanifested form, this entire world is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. Now, this was one of the verses we taught to our Gurukul students. And one year after once a week we would teach a new Bhagavad Gita verse. And one week after teaching the verse, so a couple of the new students who were like 5, 6 years old were talking on the break, and they were saying, "You know, I don't think Mother Urmila understands Krishna consciousness. What she was teaching us was wrong." So I was listening to them. Yeah. They didn't know I was listening. The other one said, "Yeah, she says Krishna is not in everything. That's not right. Krishna is in everyone's heart. He's in every atom. She told us the wrong thing." Right? And of course, then the next verse in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, "Yet everything that is created does not rest in me." So there Krishna is saying, everything is in me, but I'm not there. But everything isn't in me. And then other verses he says, "I am there." This is, of course, Arachintya Beda Beda Tattva. But the principle here is that from subtle comes gross. From subtle comes gross. So from the most subtle, the Lord, comes the subtle material elements. And these subtle material elements, from them gradually come grosser and grosser forms. So the grosser forms exist within the subtle element. We're all existing within Krishna's energy, and we're all existing within space. Yeah? We all exist within space. Internally, there's space. Externally, there's space. But at the same time, the subtle also manifests the gross. We had the class the other day about how sound manifests everything, both on a cosmic scale and on an individual scale. And here Srila Prabhupada is focusing on the point that how gross elements or grosser elements are transmitted through space. He talks about television. You know, when Prabhupada wrote this, there weren't video calls. I mean, I remember when I was, I don't know, 6 or something, going to the World's Fair, and they were demonstrating video calling as some far-out futuristic thing. I remember my mother-in-law telling me that when she was a little girl, they had been talking about television. You know, television started when I was a little girl. And my mother-in-law said that she just couldn't believe how could they throw pictures through space. She could understand how you could put sound through space. We're all putting sound through space all the time, but she couldn't understand how you're going to transmit pictures through space. And today it's just common. You know, children being born today, my youngest grandchildren, to them, the concept of picking up this little tiny box that you can fit in your pocket and having a video call with people on the other side of the planet is just normal. Right? They don't even think about it, you know, whereas maybe those of us who are older, we still think it's kind of magical, some sort of mystic power. But this concept that forms exist within space and forms can be transmitted within space. And Srila Prabhupada writes in this purport that this verse is a potential basis of great scientific research work. So we challenge the scientists to study the nature of matter. We do have one scientist, Rasaraj Prabhu, who works with the BI. And his focus is not so much on the creation of the world. A lot of the scientists focus on theistic creation rather than mechanistic creation as far as their preaching. I was just talking yesterday to Ananda and Gopi, and they're focusing on, they're doing scientific research on the nature of chanting the Mahamantra, which is very fascinating. Not very many people are researching that. So that's also subtle to gross. They're measuring the changes in the nature of the heart, of the physical heart, that happens by chanting Hare Krishna. So it's really fascinating. You may know that there's many, many studies being done on Buddhist meditation now. Everybody knows that? Yes. Lots and lots and lots of scientific medical studies being done on the benefits of Buddhist meditation in terms of the brain and the body. I remember one devotee asking me a couple years ago, he said, why aren't we doing this about Maha Mantra chanting? You know, why aren't we looking at the scientific basis? So of course, Dear Govinda, David Wolf, Dr. David Wolf, he did a study as part of his PhD thesis on chanting of Hare Krishna and the modes of material nature, and how by chanting Hare Krishna you come to the higher modes of nature. And he was also part of this study, which I know you participated in, yes, Mother Nidra. Was also a participant, and Ananda and Gopi and a few other local devotees. So they did a whole study of people chanting the Hare Krishna mantra and how it changed the heart, the physical heart. So a lot of studies have looked at the brain. This one also looked at the heart. And Gopi Bhu was telling me yesterday how, according to Ayurvedic science, that the heart is not just a muscle, but it's actually a thinking organ. It's actually thought going on in the heart. Like, I'm sure that you're all aware that within our digestive system, there's also different neurochemicals that produce various emotions. You all know that? That in our digestive system, there's things like serotonin. And even the medical doctors are saying your gut is like a second brain. So when people say, you know, I have a gut feeling, that's actually quite literal. So there's all kinds of research that can be done about, again, the subtle to gross. How does the spiritual affect the material? How does spiritual sound change the configuration of the gross body? Just like Rupa Goswami says that when one gets initiated, one's body transforms. One of the members of the Shastric Advisory Council, Hari Parshad Prabhu, I tried to get him to come to Denver, and it's just like, you guys would have absolutely loved having him here, but somehow, I don't know, it didn't happen. I think right now he's in Atlanta or Alachua. But, what was I going to say? I lost my train of thought.
Shastric Advisory Council.
Yeah, but something about subtle to gross. Oh, he's often making the point that we don't have any Prarabdha Karma. That devotees, when they get initiated, they've lost all their karma. They've lost all their Prarabdha Karma. So how does it happen? Because at the time of initiation, you get a different body. Yeah. I mean, just like a lot of these experiments being done with just impersonal meditation, that people who meditate even impersonally, it changes the biochemical nature of their body, changes their brain, changes how all the cells are developing. Anyway, everybody's getting a different body. That's happening all the time. But when one is engaged in some spiritual process, just imagine, even if you're engaged in some Buddhist process, what to speak if you're engaged in a personal process? The nature of the body changes. And you can tell that. If you're around an advanced spiritual person, you can pick up that there's something different even about their physical form. That was certainly true with Srila Prabhupada. You know, Prabhupada was given a self-winding watch and he didn't work. Because he didn't have any, like, nervous movements. You know, all of his movements were very purposeful. And I remember the first time I met with Srila Prabhupada, it was with my husband and my father. We didn't meet with him long, 20, 30 minutes maybe. And, of course, Prabhupada was always speaking very profound things. But it didn't seem to me that anything he said in that conversation would have, just by the virtue of what he said in that conversation, would have been that transforming. But when we left the room, my father looked at me and said, "Now I know why you've come to this movement. This is a genuine holy man." And, you know, I don't know why I never asked him. I don't know why I never asked my father, "What did you base that on?" But it always puzzled me. You know, how did he come to that conclusion with such a brief meeting with Srila Prabhupada? But it wasn't just what Srila Prabhupada said, but his very presence was quite different because his form was different. On a subtle and even a gross level, his form didn't act like the form of somebody who's under the modes of material nature and constantly full of anxiety. You know, when someone is constantly full of anxiety on some one level or another, the cells of their body function differently. And we can understand this on a gross level, that when we become aware of being fearful, then our breathing becomes more rapid, our pulse speeds up, right? And also another thing that happens is we have the circulation is pulled away from our digestion and our higher brain functions. Has to be, because if we're in a fearful situation, we need to react very quickly. We can't be doing some sort of analysis. Oh, that guy with the gun over there, maybe I should do this, or maybe I should do that. I was just reading about this shooting that happened, I don't know, somewhere, another shooting. Hare Krishna. And some guy who went after the shooter, he'd been in the military, and he went after the shooter and stopped the shooter. And he was saying, "It just happened so fast, I don't even know why. Why did I make the decision to turn around? Why did I make the decision to confront this guy?" He said, "I don't even know. It just happened." So our bodies are wired that when we're in danger, we don't go through some... It would be ridiculous. Well, if he moves this, I can do this, I can do that. Let me look it up on Google, let me research it. It just wouldn't be practical. So the blood is actually taken out of those higher aspects of our thinking. It goes more to like the primitive brain. And our digestion stops, you know, the blood and the energy is flowing into our arms and legs. Right? Our body changes when we're afraid. And each of the little cells in our body, well, each little cell is a living entity. So when we're fearful, when we're angry, each of those little cells also changes. They also stop doing their regular metabolism. They stop growing, they stop digesting, and they just go into a fear, protective stance. And we conditioned souls, we may not realize it, but we always have some level of fear. This is the world of death, Mrityu Loka, it's the world of anxiety. So even if we're not terrified because there's a gunman or a tiger, we have this underlying level of fear constantly. And it affects all the cells of our body and our general bodily constitution. But if you're a Bhayacharana or a Rindare, if you have no fear, just imagine how every part of your body is going to be functioning in a different way. Okay. Does that make sense to everybody? Yes? And that's going to be discernible by others. Just like we can discern if somebody's very fearful and very much in anxiety or very angry, we can tell, can't we? Yes? And when someone is completely fearless and completely surrendered, we can also tell. Well, there's something different about that person. So Krishna consciousness affects the gross body. Just like there's that famous verse in this section spoken by Devahuti. You know, that those who become devotees of the Lord, even if they're from very low births, even if their body is very contaminated by past karma, they immediately become qualified to perform Vedic sacrifices. Why? They have a different body. It actually changed. Right? Rupa Goswami says, like bell metal can turn to gold by alchemy. Of course, most of us don't know that process. Prabhupada says you have to digest mercury and then urinate on the bell metal. Don't try this, please. Mercury is a deadly poison. But there's an Ayurvedic principle by which that can be done. So we see that there's a subtle to gross. I talked the other day about the placebo effect. You know, that there's that even people get, there's been experiments where they do real surgery on some people and fake surgery on others. And both of them have the same recovery rate. Because the people getting the fake surgery where they just made an incision and closed it up, they believed that they got real surgery. And the mind healed their body. That happens. It's something well documented in medical science that if people believe that the doctor's prescribing them a medicine and they believe in the authority of the doctor, they will get better. And it can be measured. You know, their blood pressure will go down. I mean, there's actually measurements that they'll go through tests and see. It's not just that they're imagining they're better. But they actually heal their body with their mind. So there's so much evidence of subtle difference. And we know, before we do something externally, we first think of it. Isn't that correct? Yes? So to say that from space comes eventually air or the gases, air doesn't just mean, it means any matter in a gaseous form. And from there comes radiant energy, and from there comes any matter in a liquid form, and from there comes any matter in a solid form, shouldn't be such an astonishing thing. What this means is that all the qualities are there subtly in space. They'd have to be, wouldn't they? On a gross level, all the qualities are in solid matter. So solid matter has all the qualities of the preceding elements. But in some subtle form, all the more gross things must be present in the sati. And that's what's being said here. And Srila Prabhupada makes the point, and he speaks about this at length in the lecture that he gives on this verse, that this particular verse is evidence for the fact that what we think about at the time of death is what determines our next body. That thoughts that are existing within space produce a gross form of a body. So thoughts have form. They have a subtle form, but they have form. Just like the most subtle, the spiritual, we understand has form. Correct? That's our philosophy. That the most subtle, spiritual, has form. So the subtle material also has form. Our thinking, feeling, and willing actually has form. What's the evidence for that? What's the evidence that the subtle body has form? Yes?
Dreams.
Okay, that's very interesting. I like that as evidence. Who here has ever eaten anything in a dream? Did it have a taste?
Yeah.
Isn't that strange? I give this example a lot in a different context, but one time on a fast day I took a nap. I was fasting from food and water. So in my dream, I was eating. Because I was hungry, you know. So in my dream, I remember I was eating pakoras. Anyway, I was having this whole feast in my dream. But I was also very thirsty. So in my dream, I took a glass of water and I was drinking it. And then I poured myself another glass of water in my dream, and I drank that, and another glass of water in my dream, and I kept pouring these glasses of water in my dream and drinking them one after another. And finally, in my dream, I took this whole gallon jug of water, like one of those plastic gallon jugs, and I started drinking from the jug. And then in my dream, all of a sudden, I thought, something's funny here. I'm drinking all this water, and I'm still thirsty. And then I woke up, and I realized I had been drinking dream water. But I experience the sensation of drinking water in my dream, what it feels like to drink water. I experience the taste of the food in my dream. Yeah? Right? Interesting, isn't it? What's some other evidence that the subtle has form? Yeah.
Sometimes if someone is looking at you and you don't have a gross way of perceiving that visually, you can feel it.
There was actually extensive scientific evidence. Rupert Sheldrake, I believe is his name, is a big scientist, and he's done I'm pretty sure I got the right person. So he's done a lot of studies on subtle phenomena. And there's a book, and part of the title of the book is something like How You Know People Are Looking at You from Behind, and things like that. How else do we know that the subtle has form? Yeah.
Sometimes
which she endorses as phantom limbs, as well as the somewhat opposite syndrome in which the person thinks there is actually an existing limb that does not belong to them and wants to cut it off.
Thank you, Rukmini. You all know Rukmini?
Yeah.
Nice to have you with us. So phantom limb pain, do you all know what that is? So if somebody had their arm amputated, they'll still feel that the arm is there. They'll think, you know, my arm is still there, and they may get pain in their arm. It's a very difficult thing to treat. It's often treated with something called mirror therapy. But with the subtle form of the arm is still there, and it's transmitting pain signals. And then she's saying the opposite. There's a kind of mental illness where a person thinks that part of their body isn't supposed to be there. My guess about this is that in their previous life, that part wasn't there, and so they're not comfortable with having it there in this life. That's my guess. But there are people who are like, you know, my left leg, it shouldn't be here. I shouldn't have a left leg. And sometimes they convince doctors to actually amputate a healthy part of their body because they're going so crazy having the left leg there. Because there's no subtle left leg, you follow? The subtle form is not there, and so they can't figure out why the gross form is there. Again, my own guess is they had a previous life where the leg was removed and their subtle body shifted. That's my guess. Some other evidences for the subtle body having form?
The ghosts.
Ghosts.
They can see.
They can be seen, yes.
So when they move, you can sometimes feel whether they're not looking around.
Yes.
You can feel that.
Yeah, sometimes we can feel ghosts even if we can't see them. In the old New York temple, the old New York Brooklyn temple on Henry Street, so we had bought a new building in Manhattan at 55th Street that had used to be a nursing home that a lot of people died in. And the temple had, we had planned to move the temple at a certain date. And so my husband and I had given up the lease on our apartment because we thought we were all going to move. And then a few days before, and we packed up all of our stuff, and then the temple said, oh, we're not really ready to move yet, it's going to be another month. So we didn't have any place to go. And so the temple authority said, well, why don't you move into the new building, just you guys, before everybody else moves. You can stay there. Yeah. You can stay there for a month by yourself. So we only stayed there one night. So, anyway, first I went there with my oldest son. He was like maybe 1 year old. And the place was filthy. Nobody had cleaned it. There was like an inch of dirt everywhere. So I remember I kept him in his stroller while I was cleaning just the rooms where we were going to stay. And while I was there, the windows were going up and down by themselves. And the elevator was going up and down by itself. The doors were opening and closing, you know. And they didn't bother me, but anyway. They definitely had some kind of form. And many times, once the devotees moved into that building, we used to do every week some sort of ceremonies to get rid of the ghosts. So every week the devotees would go through burning frankincense and blowing conch shells and stuff. So I never saw them. But people have seen ghosts. Now when people see ghosts, what do they look like? They look like the gross body that entity had before they died. So people who can see ghosts, they'll say, oh, you know, I'm seeing a woman and she's about 40 and she has this hairdo where every hair is perfectly in place. It's, oh my God, that's my auntie. That's exactly what she was like. So they'll see the ghost that's kept this same form as the gross body. Yes, another evidence.
Remote viewing.
Can you explain that?
Well, from what I understand, please correct me if I'm wrong, but that even the government uses remote viewers to see things on other countries that they're not able to see with newer technology. Mm,
they do, in fact. In fact, the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, had a very open program of investigating paranormal phenomena. Which they were trying, they were using pretty much exclusively for the military. And there were also very open programs in this country, especially at Duke University, to investigate paranormal phenomena. And now the government says they're not investigating that anymore. Do you believe them?
No,
I don't believe them at all. So I'm sure that they're also investigating paranormal phenomena, and I'm sure they're doing it primarily for military purposes. So yes, that someone on a subtle level can see things and touch things at a distance, manipulate things at a distance, indicate that there's form. So Prabhupada would often say that our gross body is fitting on our subtle body, which is ultimately there because the spiritual body has a form. So just like today, due to the lovely weather all of you have here in Denver, so I had to wear gloves. I don't remember the last time that I had to take my gloves out of my suitcase. So you know, I came from Mangalarchik without gloves, but again, you know, I checked the weather, 31 degrees. That's below 0 Celsius for those of you in the other parts of the world. So I'm like, oh my God, I'm definitely going to wear gloves. So my gloves fit around my hand, yeah? Right? The reason my gloves have fingers is because my hand has fingers. And I have very small hands, so I got a size small glove. So not only does it have fingers like my hand has fingers, but I get a glove that's the same size. So the gross body that we have fits on our subtle body. We get a particular kind of gross body because we had a particular type of subtle body. Now, why do we get different bodies life after life? Well, that only happens if our subtle body changes. So if in this life my subtle body changes and I no longer have the subtle body of a, you know, white American female human, then in my next life I'll get a different kind of body. I was in a grocery store many years ago, and there was this woman waiting in the line who looked like an African warthog. I mean, she actually looked like an African warthog. And I thought, wow, I know what kind of body she's going to get in her next life. You know, there's competitions where people try to look like their dogs. You've seen that? Yes. Or horse?
Yeah, there's...
Seriously? People try to look like their horses?
There's like this weird thing that's going on where people dress up like horses and they have like horse shows and they have these horse competitions. It's quite disturbing.
Oh my God, Krishna. So even in this life, our gross body may change according to our subtle body. Or sometimes if you see married couples who've been together a long time and they start looking like brother and sister, have you ever seen that? No? You say, is that your brother? No, that's my husband. That's really odd. You know, and you know, you look at a picture of them when they were young and they didn't look so much alike. But after being married for a long time and having the same mentality, and of course, if people are really attached to each other, then what do they become?
Yeah.
They can switch, yes. Yes, so one devotee I know was told by an astrologer that you and your husband were married for the last 16 lifetimes, but you were always switching who was the husband and who was the wife. So that can happen. If you're really attached to another person, two people are really attached to each other, then they can literally take birth attached to each other. That happens, by the way, if you hate somebody too, not just if you love them. You know, so we have to be careful. Like if we're constantly thinking, oh, that person, yeah, yeah. Be careful with these things, you know. You'll become their child or their spouse or their parent, or maybe you'll be stuck with them in the same body. Whatever we're meditating upon. And some of that, as I said, happens in this life, that you see a change. Isn't that a fact? Huh? There'll be some change even in the physical appearance in this life. Of course, sometimes these things are, sometimes people have kind of a disconnect that seems to be happening more and more in modern society, where people feel their subtle body and their gross body doesn't match. Right? We're really struggling with that. So maybe, you know, if you're really into being a man, but still you think about your wife at the last minute at the time of death, and you get in a woman's body, and you're like, boy, I still feel like a man. What am I doing in this body? You know, so that kind of thing also happens. What our mind grabs on at the time of death. And then one just can feel very uncomfortable. I think that happens even just in ordinary life, where, you know, you fixate on something, oh, I really want that jacket, or I really want that car, and then you get it and you're like, oh, I didn't like it. why did I get this thing? I'm really so uncomfortable. Doesn't that ever happen, right? You get something, huh? Buyer's remorse, yes. Imagine if it's your body. Imagine that, you know? You have buyer's remorse for a whole lifetime. I mean, I think all of us have that to some extent, isn't it? Does anybody look in the mirror and go, that was exactly what I wanted? I don't think so, you know? So, or maybe some of you, I don't know. Yeah, and sometimes it's really extreme. I mean, and there are not even people where the men want to be women and the women want to be men. There are people who want to be lizards. You know, there really are. I mean, have you ever read about that? They really are. They get, I don't know why the doctors agree to do this, but they get doctors that implant like horns in their forehead. And they tattoo their bodies green. And they get some, you know, doctor to bifurcate their tongue. Literally, seriously. This is really going on. Obviously, not a lot of people do this, but some. And they're like, I'm really a lizard. I shouldn't be a human. You know, I feel really awkward in this human body. I don't know. Maybe some devotee gave them some prasadam, so they would jump from being lizard to human, and they're not really very comfortable. I don't know what it is, but, you know. So we really have to be careful what we think about. I was in London, and at the park near where the temple is. It's kind of a funny area of London where the temple is. But anyway, in the park near the temple, there was this woman who had short hair, and she had dyed her hair like kind of a tawny color, and then had dyed leopard spots on it. So she looked like a leopard. Okay, well, you're preparing for your next body. I saw somebody else they had pierced their cheeks so that there were fangs coming out of their cheeks. Huh? I was like, okay, you're really preparing for your next body. So we need to be careful what we think about, yeah? That's the bottom line. Why is this in the Bhagavatam? You're thinking about Maharaj Pariksit, who's about to die. You know, so you think, well, if I was about to die, I'd want to listen to the Rasalila pastimes or something. Yeah. So why is Maharaj Pariksit hearing this? Because it's very important to understand that subtle turns to gross. That where we go depends upon who we are, our whole identity is based on the subtle, is based on man mana bhava mad bhakta majujimam kamaskaru. Yam yam bhavi sram bhavam. We were talking about yesterday, maya shakta manaparta. What is absorbing us? It's not just a question of being devotees superficially, you know, learning how to put on tilak. It's not just that. It's what's our mental cultivation of Krishna consciousness. We are producing our life. We're producing our life at every moment. We are never victims. We are never victims. We are never victims. We are producing our life. We're creating our life. We're creating the circumstances of our life at every moment and on into the future. Every aspect of it. Just like the Lord, through His potency, creates the cosmos. We just read this, yes, just a couple days ago. Everybody remembers that? We are creating our own entanglement or our own liberation. It's us. Krishna is like, he's neutral. He's whatever you want, I'll help you. Whatever you want, I'll help you. Now, of course, once we take shelter of a guru, once we become initiation, once we take initiation and make a commitment to the process, then he gives up his neutrality and he says, yes, I'll especially help you. He says, I envy no one nor befriend to anyone, but anyone who is in me, I'm also in them. But that doesn't mean we don't do our part. Like Prabhupada says, Krishna doesn't tell Arjuna, go to sleep on the chariot and I'll fight for you. No. Why are we also doing our part? Because relationships can't be forced. It's voluntary. Krishna's not interested in enforcing a relationship with us. We try to do that materially. We try to force people to be what we want them to be and to relate to us the way we want them to relate to us, which is kind of a subtle form of rape. Where do we do that? Materialistic people do that. But Krishna doesn't do that. He's not going to force on any level any kind of relationship. So we have to desire it. And our desires have form. Our desires have form. Our thoughts have form. Our emotions have form. Every feeling that we have has a form. Every thought that we have has a form. Every desire we have has a form. It's a thing. It exists. And it manifests on the gross platform, or it manifests on the spiritual platform. What's really interesting is if our thoughts and feelings and desires are in tune with Krishna, then they actually dissolve the subtle body. So if our thoughts and feelings and desires are material, they create a material gross form. If our thoughts and feelings and desires are spiritual, then we were talking about the wood, remember the other day? That verse in the 11th canto, what was it? 11, 12, 18, I think. And that when you start a fire with wood, the fire eventually burns up the wood itself. So we use the mind, Kapila Dev will say, but in this section of the Bhagavatam, Kapila Dev says that you use the mind as a hook to catch the Lord. Prabhupada writes in that purport about how that non-living yoga is just using the mind, but living yoga is when the Lord manifests. But by using the mind, we attract Krishna. And by using the mind to think of Krishna, eventually the material mind dissolves and it doesn't create another gross body. And as it dissolves, the real spiritual form of the living entity of ourselves becomes manifest. So that's what we're trying to do. We're not trying to use this form of subtle energy to create another gross form. We're trying to dissolve even this subtle material energy so that the most subtle original form becomes again manifest, becomes again awakened, jivja. That's what we're trying to do. And everything we do in Krishna consciousness, whether it's done with our physical senses, whether we're cooking for the Lord or dressing the Lord, or we're cleaning the floor of the temple and we're selling books, or whatever we're doing on the gross platform, it's supposed to be changing our internal consciousness and internal awareness so we return back to the original, most subtle, and ironically, most real form of our existence. As conditioned souls, we tend to think the gross form is the most real. Actually, the most subtle is the most real. The gross form is the most unreal. Think about the temporality of the gross form. You know, our mind, intelligence, and ego is following us lifetime after lifetime. It exists for a long time, although it changes. But the gross form, it just like that, right? Burjad calculated it was 8 billionths of a second for Lord Brahma, for our lifetime. So what is the meaning of it? It's the least substantial, the gross forms. So questions, comments, additions, subtractions. Yes?
Earlier in the class, we were talking about how the body changes at initiation.
Yeah, Srila Goswami says that.
Yeah, I've heard like a couple of different explanations of what initiation actually is. Before I was took Harinam or anything like that, you know, the devotee said, okay, you're still initiated in one sense because you're initiated into the process. And we know there's like 1, 2, 3 different initiations that a person can go through formally. So if somebody's body changes, does somebody's body change instantaneously at the formal process of initiation, or is it a continuous process? Like, from what I understand, the process of initiation really is, it's continuously moving.
Well, it is true that there's a continuous process, but there's also a moment. We recognize this sort of phenomena even on a material level. Like when people get married. So that's a long-term continuous process. In our modern society, the relationship is established usually considerably before the wedding. I mean, even in a society where a marriage was arranged, the wedding wasn't generally like 2 minutes after the arrangement. You know, you need some time to invite the family and prepare for everything. So generally the arrangement would be at least a month or two in advance. So there'd be some sort of relationship. Nowadays people often have a relationship for years before they get married. And it's not that after the wedding day that then the relationship is just stuck in stone. Right? The relationship still evolves and grows, hopefully in a good way, after the wedding. But something happens at that wedding. In that instant, there's something that happens in that instant where there's a change in identity. That no matter how much the relationship was there before and how much the relationship was there after, there's something that changes there. Yes? So, or if you enroll, Prabhupada talks about initiation in terms of enrolling in a university. So you might be just attending some classes, you might be walking around the campus, you might be friends with some of the professors. Like I say, they might even allow you to come to some of their classes. Now, after you enroll, after you're formally enrolled, your relationship with the university still evolves. It doesn't, it's not like, but there's something that happens at that moment. When the university say, we accept you, and I say, okay, I'm going to come. Yeah? They send you an acceptance letter, and then you respond and say, okay, I accept your acceptance. I'll be a student. And you get a little ID card. Yeah? If any of you went to college, you get a little ID card with your picture on it and a number. And then all of a sudden, you can access things you couldn't access before. Like the library is available to you, all of the other professors. You know, my degree's in education, but I did a statistical dissertation, and so I worked with the mathematics department. So it was a different school in the university. The School of Mathematics, the School of Education. There were two different colleges within that university. But because I was enrolled in the university, the professors in the School of Mathematics also helped me. So I was going regularly, I don't remember her name, unfortunately, but I was going regularly and meeting with her, and she was helping me doing my statistical analysis. Why? Because I was an enrolled student. If I wasn't an enrolled student, she wouldn't have met with me over and over again and helped me. So when you take formal initiation, at that moment, all of the previous acharyas in the parampara, they're all available to help you. You have access to the transcendental, subtle library. Anybody can sit down and read the Bhagavatam, but, you know, just like after I graduated, 6 months after I graduated, they cut off my library access. And that was terrible. My greatest lamentation. Not seriously, was my biggest lamentation not being connected with the university is I don't have access to a university library. I used to be able to access it on my computer. So, you know, you take initiation, you're part of the parampara. Guess what? You have access to the whole transcendental library. And all of the previous acharyas, you know, we have a list of the Siksha Parampara in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, but that's just following one line. It's a whole complex tree. All of the acharyas, just like, you know, in a normal society where people have more than one kid. So you can trace your family lineage back through your parents, but there's going to be all these cousins and uncles and aunts, right? In societies where they only have one kid, that all disappears. No brothers, no sisters, no cousins, no uncles, no aunts. Just family is destroyed. But when people have multiple children, the families branch, right? And then there's part of your family by marriage also. And they're branches. And like Prabhupada will also give the example, you get married to someone, you don't just now, you're not just now related with your wife or with your husband, you're related with their whole family. So there is a defining moment. Even though you can say the change is gradual and starts way before initiation, starts the moment you say Hare Krishna, starts the moment you take one bite of prasada, that change in the physical body starts. But still, there is a defining moment where there's, you know, we are being accepted and we accept, where there's a mutual acceptance. Yes?
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. How you help us to see how material life is a process of becoming grosser and grosser, and spiritual life is the most subtle. If you could maybe give a little elaboration on a preaching perspective. You talked at length about our philosophy, how the subtle manifests into the gross. And in a world where people are really focused almost exclusively on the gross, there's a lot of baggage around pointing out that we have agency, actually. And it's seen as blaming the victim, because they have a victim mentality, because things happen by chance for them, you know, in their mind. But whereas we don't have that, we accept that whatever I'm carrying, you know, it's temporary, it's not me. But I'm carrying it because it's an activity and it's a mentality. And so I present that and have it be a liberating philosophy, which it is. without it being misidentified as blaming the victim.
Because if I have agency, then I have agency to do something about it. If I'm a victim, then I become helpless. That I'm just at the mercy of things around me over which I have no control. Wouldn't I rather have agency? But it goes together. You can't say, well, I'm a victim and I have agency. Those two things are self-contradictory. Choose. What would you rather be? Would you rather be a victim that has no agency to change anything and to improve anything? Or would you rather be the agent who's both created your fortune and your current fortune and misfortune and can create your future fortune and misfortune? It's actually liberating. Yeah, it means we have to say, ooh, you know, I haven't been using my agency very well. Okay. But that's the start to using it well. So I'll just give you a really simple example, something I was just reading about yesterday, about people who are trying to get aid workers and humanitarian workers who are trying to get people to stop... what do they call it? They don't just call it public defecation, but where people pass stool like out in the open in fields. Not that they go out, you know, and use some hole, but they pass stool in fields. And the problem with that is that human stool contains a lot of diseases. And so if people are then walking around where stool is being passed in fields, it communicates a lot of diseases among human society. So there's aid workers that are trying to get people to stop doing this, but they find that it's not very effective. If they even build some sort of a latrine or an outhouse or a toilet, people won't use it because they're not accustomed to using it. Sometimes they'll even take the latrines apart and they'll use the parts for something else. So this one of the things that's been very, very successful is that some of these international workers, they'll go into a community and they'll first take some time walking around the community and seeing where people live and where they defecate. They'll kind of map the community. And then they'll get together with everyone in the community and they'll have a map of the village. They'll have a map all drawn. And they'll take some yellow chalk and they'll say, please indicate where is the general areas for defecation. So people indicate that and they put yellow chalk on those areas on this map. And then they say, but what about when you can't get to that area? Like, let's say you're sick, you have diarrhea, right? Or it's really cold or it's really hot and you can't make it all the way to those fields. Then where do you defecate? So people start indicating that and it ends up being around the periphery of everybody's home. So then they end up, and they give people this yellow chalk and they say, sprinkle it in those areas. And when people look at the map and they see, wow, we're basically passing stool all over our entire village. And then the aid workers, they take a glass of water and they, you know, a glass of clean water, they say, you know, would you drink this? Everybody says yes. And then they take some human stool and they dip a stick into it and then they dip that in the glass of water. They say, would you drink that? Everybody says no. And they said, well, what about the flies that are in here? Are there flies? Everybody says, yes, there's flies. So what do you think the flies are doing? They show a diagram of a fly's leg and how it has little things that catch. It's not just a stick. That they're going in the stool and then they're going on your food. And so everyone just looks at this and they say, oh, we have to make a change. Because what have they realized by that demonstration? They realize that they have agency. They realize that they're not just the victims of cholera and typhoid, that these things aren't just happening to them randomly, but it's happening to them because they're passing stool everywhere in their village. They realize I'm doing activities that are causing me and the people I love to be sick. And without getting that understanding of agency, they don't change. And what I found really fascinating As the person writing this account said, the things that change people are disgust and shame. They feel disgust at what they're doing and shame at what they're doing, and that motivates them, okay, I want to make a change. So in a very similar way, all the ways in which we're making ourselves suffer are things that we're doing. And they're things that are actually disgusting and shameful. We just don't see them like that. All of our material attachments, every one of our material attachments, every one of our material desires is disgusting and shameful, all of them. But we're not perceiving them like that. Like these guys are just, well, it's my village. They were walking around all the time seeing piles of poop covered with flies all over them, all the time. But they didn't really see it, you follow? Well, this is where I live, this is what happens. So we're in this body, we're in this mind, and all the time we're seeing our piles of poop covered with flies, and we're like, well, that's just, yeah. That's what it is. And then when we have difficulty, we don't understand. Hey, you know, I got a pile of poop outside my door, and then I'm eating the food that's from the flies, that, you know, I'm eating everybody else's poop. What am I doing? Let me do something about it. Sorry, but anyway. That's, in the book I was reading, it's saying, if you don't want to hear about disgusting things, skip to the next section. But it's very powerful to understand that I'm creating my own suffering and my own enjoyment. It's a very powerful thing. It is the most powerful thing. And feeling that I'm just a victim is actually horrible. It's a terrible place to be. It's very depressing. And it just gives rise to so much anger and aggravation against everybody else who apparently is causing my suffering. So now that the questioner has asked the question and then left for the answer, but anyway. Yes?
A month ago or so, we were having this discussion about, you were speaking about the relationship between the gross body and the subtle body. But the subtle body has a certain form, so then the gross body takes a respective form like the body.
Yes.
What is or is there any relationship with the subtle body and the spiritual body? The spiritual
no.
Form?
Except just by coincidence. I mean, if you're spiritually a cowherd boy, in this life you're a male, that's just coincidence. Prabhupada makes that very clear in the Nectar Devotion. You know, it's people who are in female forms now may be cowherd boys, and people who are in male forms now may be gopis. Or, you know, we have a human form now, we might be a deer or a peacock. And you can have actually more than one spiritual form too. It's in Brihad Bhagavatamrita how the liberated soul can also expand into different forms, and Prabhupada writes that in the letter. Not as much as God, not infinite like God. But like some of the associates of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu are also monkeys in Ram Leela and cowherd boys in Krishna's Leela. So they're brahmanas in Gaura Leela and they're cowherd boys in Krishna Leela and they're monkeys in Ram Leela. So they have at least three different forms. So one can have a variety of spiritual forms simultaneously. Isn't that cool? But the relationship between our original spiritual form and our present subtle body and our present gross body, there really isn't, except by coincidence. I mean, it's just like actors, you know, in movies and theater. So, you know, they can even put an actor on stilts and give them some big costume. I mean, nowadays, what's it called? CGI? What's it called? Where they put, like, things on them? And so the actor is moving, but what a person sees on the screen is a creature. Yeah? Isn't it something like that? So there's often very little relationship between the person's physical form and the character that they portray. But even so, you know, there may be an actor who has a certain personality, but they're playing the part of somebody with a radically different personality. So we're all doing that too. Yes? Oh, okay, go ahead.
In today's purport, Srila Prabhupada points out that subtle forms exist in the ether, has been proven by modern science by transmission of television. And so, speaking about the subtle body being having ether, photographs, television, some people say that we can upload our consciousness so we can upload our subtle body to the internet and then we can live forever.
Good luck with that.
Is there no...
I have no idea, but it doesn't sound very plausible, does it?
I don't know. It's technically...
Interesting. Well, Prabhupada says that this is... that this is the potential basis of great scientific research work, so go for it. Doesn't sound plausible to me, but you can try. Check it out. Yes?
Yeah, maybe this is a speculation question, or maybe there's research out there, but for people that have like chronic depression, I just know a couple people in my life that they've had it for ever since they can remember, and then they'll even wake up and like nothing will have happened yet, and it's just like depression. And I'm just seeing like emotions are in the subtle body, and so like that coming from another life.
Well, if somebody, first of all, everything in this life has some basis in a past life.
Yeah.
You know. Although there are certain little things we do that we're just doing now, like if you eat too much for breakfast and you get a stomachache, that's not a result of your past life. But the fact that you have a particular body and a particular circumstance is coming from your past life. So it's definitely, there's some connection even to the little choices you make in this life. But if someone from a very, very young age has some sort of mental difficulty, and this most the younger something starts, the most likely you are with the past life connection. A lot of mental difficulties are also due to subtle entities in this life. So societies used to understand that a lot more, I think, than we do today. I know a devotee who was a medical doctor, and he was mentally healthy, and then one day he became extremely mentally ill while he was walking around the hospital. And I said, you know, it's... to have some sudden thing like that, no history of mental illness in your family, no stress in your life or anything like that. You know, there are people dying in the hospital. You may have been attacked by some sort of subtle entity. So that's always a possibility when a person has some sort of mental difficulty. Mental difficulties can also be due to curses. Please don't think this is just something we read about in the Bhagavatam and that it's not necessarily applicable in 2019. But like we have in the Bhagavatam, someone gets cursed to be a Rakshasa. And, you know, when he was cursed like that, his mentality changed. It wasn't just that his form changed, his mentality changed. Do we have lots of instances of people who were cursed to be demons or whatever? So, yeah, you know, that's also a possibility. That can happen in this life or another life, especially if you get cursed by a Brahmana. That's real stuff. So, yeah, mental problems can be caused by curses. It can be caused by subtle entities. It can be caused by... a lot of times, people who take intoxication open themselves up to subtle entities. People who take intoxication, people who take drugs, alcohol, it weakens the subtle body so that lower entities can affect you more. So there's all sorts of varieties of why people struggle with... I'm not saying those are the only causes, and every individual is an individual. You know, you have to look at an individual as an individual. It's not that every case of depression is caused by this and this and this. There may be all kinds of factors that are involved. Sometimes in this life, a person goes through trauma and their subtle body goes into depression as a way of dealing with the trauma. And one psychologist that I knew, he compared it that you have a leaking faucet and you just shut off the water to the whole house. So your faucet doesn't leak anymore. That depression, I mean, he actually specialized in treating depression. And that was how he functioned. He said that depression is a response to some sort of trauma. And that everything just, the mind just shuts down and says, I just can't deal with anything. But I'm sure, again, that's not the only explanation. With some people, it may be entirely a physiological cause, what they're eating, how they're exercising, what they're doing. I mean, if you're going to look at holistic integrative medicine, it's going to look at all sorts of different causes for both physical and mental things.
Yeah.
Is that right? It's a quarter after nine. I'm sure people are hungry. Is there anything else that people urgently wanted? Yes.
Just a quick question, a personal question. So you're saying how someone can be identified as like a lizard or something, but they're in a human body. Is the opposite also the same, or someone can be identified as a human, but they're stuck in an animal body?
Absolutely. We have many examples of that in the Shastra. We have King Riga, who was in a lizard body but had a human consciousness. We have Nalukavera and Manigriva, who were in tree bodies but had a human consciousness. Oh yeah, definitely that can happen.
For example, Catherine in prison, she's very much acting like a human. She takes darshan.
Yeah, that kind of thing can happen. Yeah, we had a cat like that. Actually, Jananda Maharaj wrote a book about animals and Krishna consciousness. And Jananda Maharaj, he's a great guy. Like, he probably doesn't come here, does he? I don't know if he comes to America at all. What a fun person he is. He's a real Harinam Bhakta. Loves going out in Harinam. Yeah. He's British. Huh? He's from Great Britain, yeah. Anyway, he's such a happy person. Anyway, he wrote this book on animals and Krishna consciousness, and he wrote about animals who would come regularly to see the deity and things like that. We had a cat in North Carolina. One devotee, Gopal, brought his cat, Tom, luck to Tom. And in the North Carolina temple room, there's windows. The temple room itself is up a flight of stairs, and it's a dome. But there, the windows and the doors, there's glass doors. Glass doors that, of course, go all the way down to the floor level. And yeah, we have windows up there too, actually, that are at floor level. And so Bhakta Tam would come every morning to Mangalartik. And he'd sit outside. We wouldn't let him in, but he'd sit outside. And while we're singing, he's going, meow, meow, meow. And he'd come every day to Bhagavatam class, and he would just sit there quietly. And then when we said, anyone have any questions? He'd go, meow. And he was a very odd cat. The only cat-like thing he did was to produce kittens with the female cats. But otherwise, he didn't engage in any cat activities. So he was quite sickly. Because cats need to eat meat, but he basically just didn't, and he would only eat prasada. And he would eat like a person. You know how cats just eat with their mouth, but he would eat with his paw, and he would do this, and he would eat this. And he would eat weird things like watermelon. You never heard of a cat eating watermelon. So sometimes, yeah, you have these animals. And of course, Bart Maharaj. Actually, I listened to Prabhupada's lecture on today's verse. I listened to it yesterday and today. And Prabhupada was talking about Bard Maharaj, and even though he was such an advanced devotee, he took birth as a deer, but as a deer, he had a human consciousness. So, yeah, there are definitely, certainly, and I'm sure that's true right now. So you've got people walking around as humans who have a lizard consciousness, and you have lizards walking around who have a human consciousness. Yeah, that happens. It's not supposed to happen that way. That's an aberration. Something hasn't gone the way it's supposed to go. I mean, even there aren't supposed to be ghosts. Ghosts are stuck. It's kind of an elevator that's gotten stuck between floors. You know, they've left one body, but they're still hanging on to the identity of that body. And they can't go on to the next body. And Prabhupada says, that's why in Vedic society you cremated the body by the next sunrise or sunset, so that the subtle entity, their body was destroyed. It would help them to understand that that's not me anymore. I have to move on. But that, it's not supposed to happen. People aren't supposed to become ghosts. It's not the way Krishna would like things to go on. You know, people are they're not dealing with the system. Probably. It's very unfortunate.
Yeah, the whole, when you're not saying the cat
that
you're supposed to come back in the body that you're in.
Huh?
Right?
Yeah, well, these Christians who think you're going to come back in the body that you're in.
Yeah, and so then they're buried alive.
That's too bad, isn't it?
And they're stuck.
Yeah, that's really a shame. There's a lot of Christian groups who think that the resurrection means that the bodies are going to jump out of the grave and be alive again. I mean, okay, that's not in the Bible. You know, that's not in the Bible. It's something that they have concocted to fill a gap in their understanding. Be wary of filling gaps in your understanding by making things up. Even devotees do that. They have some gap in their understanding and they just make something up. So be careful, because they've just made that up. And if you ask them and you say, well, so I have to come back like this, but suppose I don't like my body. Like, I don't like my nose. I really don't. And I don't like my hair either. Never have. So I have to have this nose and this hair forever? And I asked them that. You know, I have to have my same nose and my hair for eternity? They said, well, you'll like it. I mean, it wasn't satisfying. Somehow when I get, you know, when I get resurrected, then I'll go, oh, I love this wispy Northern European hair that never stays where you put it. I just don't think that's going to happen. And then at what age do you get resurrected? I mean, I do appreciate having an older body for many reasons. There's a lot of nice things about having an older body. But that doesn't mean I want to be in an older body eternally. Like, yuck. You know, so if somehow I live to be 105, then I have to get resurrected as 105 forever? I'm eternally. I mean, seriously? Or you die when you're 2, you have to be 2 forever? And you ask them these questions and they just go, I don't have any answers. It's really silly. You know, it's a very unfortunate. This has got to be the last one. It's 9:24. I know that clock's a little fast, but still. Yes?
I'm appreciating the point about how our subtle body must be burned away, essentially, or dissolved.
Yes.
And that by that dissolution happens by us bringing our consciousness to Krishna.
Yes.
And, you know, over and over again. And how important that is, that just the knowledge of how fire is within wood, and that we have to ignite it out. Bring it out of the wood to turn out the wood.
Yes.
Similarly, the subtle body, the advantage of being in the human form to dissolve the subtle body. And I'm thinking how that relates to devotional service, and how if we just stay on the mechanical level, that it doesn't ignite the fire.
No, it doesn't.
It dissolves it.
Yeah. Was that a question? Or do you have, or comment? It was a lovely comment. Was there a question in there?
I'm wondering what percentage does mechanical emotional, apparent emotional service really purify? Does it purify at all?
Well, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur in Madhurya Kadambini, when he does indicate some purification happening before even Bhajana Kriya. So purification starts happening at Sadhu Sangha. And there is some purification happening before an Arjuna Vritti. So there is some level of purification that happens just on the gross level. You know, if you chant the holy name, you take prasadam, it does change, it does have some effect. But just like we read that quote from Prabhupada, where first he said, it's useless. He was saying, if you're chanting mechanically and thinking of some other things, it's useless. And when you actually hear that, if you go to that conversation and listen to it and hear it, it's heavy. You hear it and you go, oh. And then Prabhupada has this pause and he said, it will take some time. And then you go, ah. You know, but it takes a long, long time. Like Prabhupada said, if you want to light a fire with wet wood, first you have to dry the wood. So there is some effect, but it's... And in the beginning, honestly, we see that people, when they first take up Krishna consciousness, the effect can be very dramatic. Yeah. By the way, that happens to anybody who takes up religious life in any genuine religious system. It's not just in the Hare Krishna. That when a person goes from being a materialistic person and says, my dear Lord, I surrender to you. I'm yours. I want to dedicate myself to you. There's usually this time of sort of extraordinary changes, which I understand that to be a kind of mercy, that Krishna is just so happy that he has some very large and discernible effects in a person's life immediately. But yeah, no, there's something. Otherwise, why would we be giving prasadam to people who don't know anything? You know, my father, I was talking about my father when we met Prabhupada for the first time. That was one of the questions that my father asked Srila Prabhupada. He said, I'm in the food business, and I'm wondering why you're so eager to give your food to people who don't know your philosophy. And Prabhupada was in a very casual mood. He was sitting like this, and a cushion, and he had his dhoti up over his leg like that. You could see his right leg, his feet. And Prabhupada said, do you believe in infection? And my father says, yes. He says, so just like if you eat the food of an infected person, you'll become sick. He said, so if you eat the food that Krishna's eaten, then you'll get infected with Krishna's disease. And we said, you know, Prabhupada sometimes on a morning walk, the devotees would be feeding some ducks. And Prabhupada said, oh, they'll take prasad and they'll take a human birth. And they said, Prabhupada, we feed them every day. He said, then they can go back to Godhead. So there is some effect. We call that agyata sukriti. So there is some effect of agyata means without knowledge. But ultimately, there has to be a change in the person. Because it's all based on desire. Krishna's not going to force. So there does have to be a change in desire. There has to be something on the part of the living entity. Is that all right? Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada.